the State of Florida Sports Podcast, presented by the USA Today Network. Here's your host, Tim Walters.
Florida's cold weather is all but gone. As the spring and sizzling heat of summer approaches, that can only mean one thing. It's time to check in with outdoor reporter Ed Killer of the Treasure Coast Newspapers and TCPalm.com. No one knows what's going on with fishing, boating, or environmental issues like Ed. He'll be here in just a moment to talk about the controversial red snapper season, the impending jellyfish invasion, gag grouper Lake Okeechobee, and more. Hello again, everybody. I'm Tim Walters, and thank you once again for joining me on the State of Florida Sports Podcast, powered by the USA Today Network. This podcast utilizes our Florida Sports Network of beat writers, columnists, and some special guests to bring you up to speed on the most important sports topics. Our Florida network consists of 17 news sites that encompass the state. We encourage you to subscribe to your hometown newspaper and, of course, this podcast to help support the incredible journalism done by our talented staffs. Ed Killer is one of the state's foremost experts on all issues dealing with the outdoors. He's wandered out of the wilderness like Sasquatch, and he's here now to tell us what he knows. Ed, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, you know, perhaps the state's most controversial issue last year in 2023 was the oddly short two-day Atlantic side red snapper season. And this year, Ed, Atlantic anglers may not even get that. So tell us what's new here on the red snapper front.
Well, the federal fishery managers who are responsible for managing the Atlantic Ocean fisheries, they and they're separate from the ones that manage the Gulf Coast fisheries. So first, that's the first thing anglers in Florida need to understand. Red snapper is a species that lives in offshore waters, usually around 90 to about 160, maybe 200 feet deep. They have kind of a narrow range along the Atlantic coast of habitat that they live in, and they can grow to about 40, 45 pounds. So it's a great snapper to catch. It's good table fare. Everybody likes eating snapper. It's not a very fishy flavor. It's very mild, flaky white meat. You can cook it a variety of ways. So people love catching them. The problem is that according to the fish stocks data by the federal fisheries managers, that we're really looking at a fishery between about Jupiter on the southern end of the coast. The ranges to about Jupiter all the way up to Jacksonville and then beyond up into North Carolina. And these fish are overfished, they say. They say that there's too much fishing pressure on them. We're harvesting them too much. So what they've done is they've allowed us to have certain fishing seasons through the years. And in 2010, they closed down the fishery to any kind of fishing whatsoever. And then in subsequent years after that, they've allowed us to fish for 6 days or 5 days. But the last couple of years, it's only been 2 days. And it looks like this year, they're not going to allow us to have any days of fishing for red snapper on the Atlantic coast. So that's something that we haven't heard the final word yet. And federal fisheries managers are going to be meeting in a few weeks to discuss whether or not they're going to allow it to happen. The previous past several years has been, the season has been after 4th of July, but before the lobster mini season, which is always the last Wednesday and Thursday of July. So they've usually done the red snapper season around July 7th to 9th, somewhere around in there. And so we're going to find out later this year if they're going to allow Atlantic anglers to fish for them at all. And they may decide not to allow for any season. The disparity is going to be that pretty soon we're probably going to hear about the Gulf of Mexico fishery being in pretty good shape. And Governor Ron DeSantis is probably going to announce that there will be as many as 40 to 50 to even 60 fishing days allowed in 2024 for red snapper in the Gulf of Mexico fishery. So according to fishery managers that I've spoken to, there's a lot more habitat available in the Gulf of Mexico than there is in the Atlantic Ocean. Even though the last time I checked, I'm not really good on geography, but when I looked at a map, the Atlantic Ocean is way bigger than the Gulf of Mexico. So I'm not sure how that works out, but that's what I was told.
Yeah, I mean, you're certainly right about the size. Now, you're the one that gets out a lot more than me. You talk to the people who are out there more. But I feel like, Ed, people have said that it's a little bit overstated because they say they go out fishing and they catch red snapper and have to throw them back. So if the number is that few, then, you know, what's true? Is what the fisheries and the state are saying are true? Or do you believe the boaters who are actually going out there and saying, you know, we'd love to keep them, but we can't?
Well, that's where the problem lies, really, is that they call that in fishery science, they call that when you go catch a fish and you see it firsthand with your eyeballs and then you let it go, they call that anecdotal data and they disregard it. They like to use numbers that they figure out on pieces of paper with slide rules and calculators, and that's how they can really tell how the fishery's doing offshore. I don't understand any of this. I've criticized it for years in columns. I still criticize it. I know that they're using the best fishery science available to tell them, you know, what the stocks are doing out there. But like you said, the people that are actually doing the fishing, that are fishing in that zone where they're bottom fishing and, you know, 90 feet, 100 feet, they're off of Port Canaveral, Daytona Beach, New Smyrna Beach, St. Augustine, Jacksonville, Mayport, you know, these places right along the northeastern coast of Florida, they tell me that they cannot catch another species of fish in these areas because the red snapper schools are so big. And what they'll do is the snapper school will stage on top of the reef. So if the reef is on the bottom in 100 feet of water, and maybe it's got 6 or 10 feet of relief, there's a school, there's all kinds of fish around the reef, but the red snapper school will actually stage about 10 feet over the reef. So if you drop a bait down with a weighted hook, by the time the bait gets down to the reef, it has to go through a red snapper school, and those red snapper are aggressive predators. So they'll take your bait and you've got to fish on right away. And the second part of the problem is during the springtime, we've really noticed along this Atlantic shelf, really a high degree of shark activity. So a lot of these red snapper that they're hooking in 100 feet of water in March, as they reel them up, they're getting hit by sharks. They're getting killed by sharks. And, you know, you're not allowed to keep the fish anyway, and all you're bringing back is half a fish. So you're tossing that over. Even if you toss over a whole fish to hope it gets back down to the bottom 100 feet, the sharks are hanging around your boat anyway. So they're usually going to take the fish too, because the fish is tired from the fight, and the sharks can come out. So we're really running into a crux of two major problems that are happening right now along the east coast of Florida, that are creating problems with our fishery management structure. So what they're going to do to prevent this, I have no idea, but they've discussed things as draconian as closing off like the whole bottom fishing area in 100 feet of water. And a little bit deeper, completely closing it off in like the North Florida, half of Florida, which is going to be completely unacceptable to tell people that they have no access to bottom fish anywhere outside of like 90 feet of water. It's just not going to work for people. It'll shut down entire businesses, party boats, charter boats. The weekend warrior guy, he's not going to want to own a boat anymore. He's going to sell his boat. You know, the manufacturers are going to feel that ripple. So it's a big problem that could be looming, and not only just a fishery management problem, but also a socioeconomic problem that could affect some of the towns along Florida's northeast coast.
Well, I guess we're going to have to stick to your reporting again, edkiller@tcpalm.com, as we get nearer to that season, because as you say, that usually happens after July, and, you know, we'll wait for official word. But hey, maybe the fishermen are just catching the same red snapper over and over. There's just one out there and they have to keep throwing the poor guy back. But
yeah, he's got sore lips.
Yeah, we'll call him Andy Dalton. You know, the Red Rifle, the Red Snapper. Who knows? We'll see.
There you go.
All right. Well, moving on, Ed. I recently read a story that you had up there. You know, obviously this affects people who love going to the beaches, especially along the Atlantic coast, and that is jellyfish are starting to arrive. So, you know, usually they're jellyfish season, so to speak, in Florida. So how bad do you think it's going to be this year? How long do they stick around? And, you know, tell us what else you know about the gelatinous members of the subphylum Medusazoa.
That's easy for you to say. By the way, congratulations for the first time in this podcast getting the word subphylum on the podcast. You must have got paid $10 to get that out there. But anyhow, the I don't think it's going to be any different than any other year. There's no indicators to me that there's some strange abundance of jellyfish that's floating around in our waters right now. We did have a little bit of a bloom back in 2012, I think it was, during the late summer. We had like a July, August, we had this moon jellyfish bloom offshore, which was really weird, and it was very extensive. It was probably, it ranged from like Palm Beach County waters to like almost Indian River County waters. And it even caused a problem with the intake pumps at the St. Lucie Nuclear 2 power plant, which we didn't find out about for about 5 years afterwards. So that the jellyfish almost caused a meltdown of the plant. But anyway, that would have been a bad deal. This year though, what I wrote about was these little jellyfish called by the wind sailors. And I've never heard that term before. I always thought they were just a form of Portuguese man of war. A lot of people are very familiar with the Portuguese man of war. It's a little bigger than maybe a softball, and it's got this kind of gelatinous, puffy, air-filled sac that causes it to blow around in the wind and then the current, and it drifts around the currents. It's got long tentacles. Well, the Portuguese man of war, the tentacles, they could sting pretty good. They're not fun to get stung by at all. If you do get stung, you got to have some meat tenderizer. I don't know the last time you brought meat tenderizer to the beach with you, Tim, but that might help a little bit if you have some. But in those tentacles, you got these little things called nematocysts. They're like little single-celled organisms, and they're designed to catch a fish when a small fish swims by. They can catch the fish, stun the fish's nervous system to where the fish stops moving, and then it can slowly consume the fish, and that becomes food. But what ends up happening is this time of year, we get southeast breezes, and the Gulf Stream is moving from south to north off our coast from Key West all the way to Jacksonville. And what happens is as those Portuguese man of war are drifting north in the Gulf Stream current, the southeast winds blow them into our shores. So anywhere from as far south as, Boca Raton to as far north as Jacksonville, you can get these Portuguese man of war blowing up on the beaches at certain times of the year during certain tides and certain wind conditions. When the winds shift around like they do in the springtime to blow, as a front is coming, the winds will shift to the southwest and then to the west and then eventually the northwest. It blows those organisms out to sea and moves them away from shore, where they're not a problem with swimmers and surfers and, people, riding on rafts and stuff like that and wading in the water. So when those Portuguese man of war are close to shore, they can become a problem. And when they're away from shore, they don't become a problem, but they're usually not that bad. A lot of times if you go to a guarded beach, the guards are all up and down the east coast of Florida, all have a purple flag that they'll fly. And if you see the purple flag flying, it means there's Portuguese man of war in surf, and to watch out because that could create a problem for you. But these little things called by the wind sailors, they look exactly the same color as Portuguese man of war, but they're much smaller and they're much less stingy. They don't really sting that bad. So if you come in contact with one of them, it's probably not going to be as serious of a sting. There might be a little bit of a mild irritation, and if you're allergic to it, that might be a problem, but they're really not going to cause that much of a problem. And they're only about as big as like a human ear. And that's what they look like. They look like a little human ear laying flat with a tiny little sail on top. And what I learned about these organisms when I was writing about them last week is that they've got two S-shaped sails on them. The ones in the northern hemisphere have an S-shaped sail that when the wind blows, it keeps it out to sea. And the ones in the southern hemisphere, the S-shaped sail is opposite is on the organism in an opposite fashion in a different direction, and that's what keeps it out to sea in the southern hemisphere. So I thought that was kind of weird, but we did have a few blow up on the beach here last couple of weeks. So I was just kind of doing a public service announcement to kind of tell people what's going on.
Lego, I don't know. I'm still stuck on at the beginning of your answer. You talking about jellyfish nearly causing a meltdown in a nuclear plant, which sounds like it could be either a great idea for a comic book or a horrible thing of nuclear jellyfish that, you know, grow legs and walk on the land and take people over. So thanks for frightening me on two fronts there, Ed.
Exactly. No problem.
All right. So, you know, more of your reporting that I was looking over recently, Ed, you know, you were, we've talked about this for years on this podcast, issues that are plaguing Lake Okeechobee. And, you know, every time it seems like there's some sort of glimmer of hope, that glimmer just gets quickly extinguished. So the most recent discharges, they're causing all sorts of issues for South Florida. So what is the current crux of the problem? And you're the expert. How do we fix this thing?
Well, those are both answers that are too long for this podcast. So I'm going to try to give you the short version, the bullet points. But for those of you that are not familiar with it, Lake Okeechobee is a giant lake. It's a freshwater lake, and it sits right there in the middle of South Florida. It's right there between, say, where Stewart is on the east side, and where Fort Myers is on the west side. So it's located probably pretty much right between the two of them. And it's huge. It's like 40 miles across. That's 730 square miles in lake area and 467,000 acres. It's enormous. It is the second largest freshwater lake, natural lake, that's completely contained within U.S. borders, second in size only to Lake Michigan. And so it's really big. If you go stand on the shore of it, you can't see across it because you can only see a line of sight about 6 or 7 miles. But like I said, Lake Okeechobee is 40 miles across. That's how big this is. The problem is that back in 100 years ago, back in the 20s and early 30s, the federal government decided to build what's essentially a dam that goes all the way around the outside of the lake. That's called the Herbert Hoover Dyke. And it's 144 miles around in circumference. And what happens is the water that flows south all the way as far north as Orlando and Kissimmee, all that water that flows south in that watershed, about 40 miles wide and about 100 miles long, flows from north to south into Lake Okeechobee. So every time we get a tropical storm or any kind of rainfall in that area, it fills up Lake Okeechobee. And the way that the lake has been designed is they've built two canals, one that goes east to the St. Lucie River and one that goes west to the Coosatchee River. And those are the only meaningful outlets of water that the Army Corps, who controls the lake level, the Army Corps of Engineers can only use those two canals to release large volumes of water. Well, when that water comes downstream into the brackish and salty estuaries near the St. Lucie River and Coosatchee River, that fresh water alone, the volume of fresh water, causes major ecological problems. And then what's being carried in that water is nitrogen, phosphorus, and silt. And all those things are also causing more problems as they flush downstream. It's a system that was designed, it's a plumbing system, it was designed 100 years ago to drain water so that the land south of the lake could be get prime irrigation for agricultural crops. And that's what they use it for. There's about 344,000 acres of agricultural crops south of Lake Okeechobee that benefit from ideal irrigation. The water used to flow all the way through that area down into the Everglades back before man got here, right around the turn of the 1900 century there. But anyway, since then, we've created this system where it just flushes to the east and west. What's going to fix it is creating infrastructure so that the water can go from the lake south to the Everglades. And that is 50 to 100 years in the distance. It's going to cost, right now the price tag is about $23 billion for these projects to help clean the water and then move it south into the Everglades. And we've been working on it for 20 years, and we're not even close to even scratching the surface of being done with these projects. So that's the only thing that's going to keep that water from going east and west into the estuaries and going south to the Everglades where it was supposed to go in the beginning. And that's where we are in this whole thing. We're looking at huge price tags, long timelines, and situations where the Army Corps of Engineers and the South Florida Water Management District are the two agencies in control of the whole thing. And they're not really two agencies that are set up to receive input from the population that's screaming and yelling about how we need to change this for the future of Florida's water. So we're stuck with this problem again. And just real quick to update you right now, we're nearing the end of the first month of what we had to have discharges to the St. Lucie River and Caloosahatchee River down to Fort Myers and over to Stewart. And over the last month, they've discharged about 5 billion gallons of water a day for a month. And they've only dropped the level of Lake Okeechobee about 7 inches in that time. So it shows you like how idiotic this whole system is and how the people that live in Stewart and Fort Myers are really getting the short end of the stick on this.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, just watch this, you know, issue me personally for, you know, 4 decades of living here in Florida. And it just, it always seems like people are frustrated and the numbers you throw out there, 50, you know, 100 years before they get this fixed, if they were to even get serious about it. It's just an awful thing. So, you know, Ed, you always do such a great job reporting on it. So, you know, again, edkillertcpalm.com, make sure to check out his reporting on Lake Okeechobee because he always does great work there. So, Ed, a couple of more fishing things before we, you know, start wrapping up here. We're coming into the gag grouper season. And, you know, here's another thing, kind of like red snapper, you know, overfishing, you know, is supposedly hurting their numbers. So how is the gag grouper season going to be affected in 2024 along the Atlantic coast for fishermen here?
You know, Tim, I wasn't thinking about what you would title this podcast, but I guess it would be if it's not bad news, then there's no news coming from Ed Killer this week. You know, it's just, I feel like old man Jenkins, everything I'm saying is negative, you know? Anyway, the state of the gag grouper season this coming year is pretty grim. So let me give you a real quick refresher. Again, we're talking about overfishing. These gag grouper, for people that aren't familiar with them, they live on the offshore fishing reefs. You can catch them inshore, but usually not of legal size. They've got to be at least 24 inches, I think, to harvest. And you can only take one per day per angler, and then there's a maximum of like 2 per vessel or 3 per vessel. So please check those fishing regulations before you go. But the season goes from, it opens on May 1st, and then it's supposed to be open till the end of the year. And they have a spawning season closure in the months from January through April every year to protect gag grouper and then some other popular grouper like black grouper, red grouper, scamp, and then there's a few minor species that they also protect. This year, though, gag grouper, they think, is becoming overfished. And they had to close the season last year. Instead of letting it go all the way to the end of the year, they had to close it in October. Because they had calculated that there's a number they call the annual catch limit for the South Atlantic fisheries area, and they had determined that the catch limit had already been reached by recreational anglers, so they closed down the whole fishery to recreational anglers in October. They think it's in such bad shape though that this year they're thinking they're going to have to close the season probably by June 15th. Which means that you're going to have basically a 6-week window to catch gag grouper in the Atlantic on the east coast of Florida from May 1st to about June 15th. And then they're probably going to close the season again to protect what's left of the grouper. One of the things that doesn't help the grouper is this. They're a highly desirable food fish, and they can grow to, you know, 40 pounds. It's not uncommon to catch a 30, 35 pound grouper. offshore, and they'll live anywhere from, you know, they, in that same area where the Atlantic red snapper lives. They live in these deep water reefs from, you know, 90 feet. You don't really catch them much. You don't catch a lot of them inshore 90 feet, but you can catch them out to 160 to 200 feet on some of these deep water coral reefs, these slow growing reefs that grow off of Port Canaveral and Fort Pierce and places like that. Fort Pierce, Sebastian, those, you know, Port Canaveral, those were all pretty good gag grouper fishing grounds for a number of years. But the problem is the fish doesn't even reach sexual maturity till it's about 7 years of age. And that's a long time in the life of a lifespan of an offshore fish, like a grouper, that's highly desirable by not only people, but by other fish like to eat it too. So, it's hard to get the groupers to 7 years old where they reach sexual maturity and then create more groupers. But in any case, what the feds are trying to do is they're using their fancy math again, and they're trying to figure out a way to protect the resource so it doesn't get overfished for future generations. They want to make sure that we've got gag grouper around for years and years to come. So that's why they're creating these, this 6 week season. And that's also back to that first topic we talked about. That's why they may not even have a red snapper fishing season this year. So, that's the purpose of it. And on the flip side, of course, is the anglers that were probably going to be upset. Now, some of the, and this is the last thing I'll say about gag grouper. I talked to a guy who was an excellent gag grouper fisherman for years out of Fort Pierce, only about a week and a half ago. And he was complaining about it. He said, there's no gag grouper out there. And he doesn't mind if they close down the season for a couple of years, because he said they got to do everything they can to protect the species as far as he's concerned. He thinks that there's places like, because of the way they've structured the commercial fishing limits, there's places where these commercial fishermen will actually dive for them and use spear guns. And when they go down to like a reef, say a reef is like as big as your living room, they'll go down to that reef, and grouper are very territorial. They'll stay in that one section of the reef, and a group of commercial fishermen with spear guns can go down there and take every legal sized grouper off that reef. Therefore, like cleaning off the reef, essentially a grouper, in a matter of, you know, a matter of one tank, you know, a half hour or something, they can do that. And that has probably created a big problem for grouper, the future of grouper stocks, along the east coast of Florida. So, that's about all I have to say about that. But we're looking at maybe a 6 week season, but they have not announced it officially yet. So that will be coming. That'll be something we'll be reporting on when it is announced and when it's made known to everybody.
So Ed, I'm curious, you know, we're talking about all these limitations on all these different things. What can people be fishing for right now? What are they still allowed to go out on their boats or go out on their shores and try and catch? And what's looking good here in the spring break into spring timeframe?
You know, that's a great question. It's a $64,000 question. Like, what can we actually catch out there? So, but it's not as bad. It's not all bad. There's some good news out there too. This time of year, the springtime, especially along the Atlantic coast of Florida where I live, but also somewhat on the Gulf coast of Florida where I've lived before, and I don't really cover it as much, but I keep an eye on what's going on over there. But this is the time of year when we have some pretty big fish migrations. So the fall months and the spring months are transition months for these fisheries. A lot of these fish will move north and south during the different seasons of the year. They're going south where they're going to spawn and spend the winter. They go north where they feed all summer long and have more babies. So there's a big cycle of life that's going on in our oceans, right off our coasts on both sides of Florida every year. Right now we've got fish like pompano, bluefish, and Spanish mackerel, and sharks. And they're all moving north. And, the sharks are following the Spanish mackerel and the bluefish, which they're trying to eat. The bluefish and the Spanish mackerel are following sardines. And they're also following menhaden and other species of bait, which are moving north to some degree. There's some mullet moving north. We don't see this great spring mullet migration like we see in the fall. The fall, we see it moving south, the big, huge fall mullet run. But But back in this, and when you get around to the spring months, those mullet are actually coming back, and they're coming back, and they're coming into our estuaries and coming through our inlets and coming, you know, coming up the East Coast and West Coast. But with them, you've got a whole bunch of other fish coming. We had a great fishing year for bluefish this winter, where there was really some large ones caught all the way from, like, you know, the Brevard County beaches and then down into the Treasure Coast beaches and the Palm beaches. They saw these big bluefish up to 15 pounds, these really big ones. I mean, the state record for Florida is only 22 pounds. And we saw some big 15 pounders caught from people fishing from the surf, like right there on the shoreline at the beach. They caught these big ones. Guys at the jetties, like Sebastian Inlet Jetty, or at the piers, like Juneau Beach Pier, Lake Worth Beach Pier, you know, Dania, down at Dania Pier. You know, these people caught these big, massive bluefish all season long. But those bluefish are now starting to migrate back to the north. We also get big Jack Crevalles this time of year that come around up to 40 pounds. They come in big schools just along the beaches in about 20 feet of water. You can get out there in like a bay boat on calm days, and you can see these big schools of maybe 100 fish in a school, and they daisy chain in a big circle while they engage in a spawning activity. And if you can cast a bait or a lure, a topwater plug or a chrome jig in the middle of that, you've got action for the next 30 minutes on this big, you know, Jack Crevalle. It's going to take you around the boat 10 times. We've got some kingfish now coming up our beaches. They'll be out into a little deeper water, out to about 40 feet, up to 60 feet. Really good lane snapper fishing right now on the bottom. And the great thing about lane snapper is you don't have to go all the way out, you know, miles from the beach out to 90 to 100 feet where these gag grouper and red snapper live that are overfished. You can fish in 40 to 60 feet of water for lane snapper on reefs in there, and you can catch all the lane snapper you can take home. And, you know, there's a limit on them. I think it's 10. I think it's 10 per day. But just check myfwc.com for those regulations. But the lane snapper, they're not a big snapper. They only grow to about 3-4 pounds. But I've seen a bunch of 4-pounders caught this year off of places like Stewart and Fort Pierce. And you got mutton snapper, which grow to 14 to 20 pounds. You got a lot of them out there. Mangrove snapper, which can get up to 9-10 pounds. And these are all through Port Canaveral, all through, you know, New Smyrna Beach. You can catch these mangrove snappers, some lane snappers, some vermilion snapper, porgies. There's a lot of porgies species. There's like 5 porgy species you can catch out there. Triggerfish, that's a delicious eating fish. And like I said, kingfish. And then a lot of times when you're fishing these reefs, one of the bonuses you'll get is every once in a while, a cobia will come up. You know, it might be 30, 40 pounds might come up into your bait spread, and somebody might catch one of them too. So a lot of good fishing out there right now to be had along both coasts of Florida.
All righty. Well, we'll end it there with the good news of what you can catch, because there were so many tidbits earlier, and I'm still a little shocked about nuclear jellyfish walking around the earth. But Ed, is there anything else you want to get in front of the audience before I let you go here?
No, just, you know, we live in a great state, and there's a lot of great things going on. You know, we got March Madness starting up this week, and we got, you know, spring training winding down, and the baseball season is going to start soon. So, you know, the golf had one of its big events with the Players Championship this weekend. So a lot of good things going on in Florida. So even if you're bored because you're a football fan, there's a lot of other things to keep you busy the next few weeks.
Yeah, and I was up there for the Players Championship in Ponte Vedra Beach near Jacksonville. Got beautiful weather this year. 2 years ago, it was like you needed an ark. We got so much rain. So it was really nice to see beautiful weather. Great surge at the end by Scottie Scheffler. So if you're not a golf fan, you missed something exciting. But it really was a lot of fun. And yeah, I'm sure also, what are we in March now? So we're about 2 months away from Jimmy Butler turning on the switch and taking the Heat back to another final, right? Because it doesn't matter if they're the 8th seed, you know, if they're making it in barely to the playoffs, whatever it is, you know, Jimmy's going to go on a run. So you're more of a Heat fan. I'm more of a Magic fan, Ed.
Yeah, playoff Jimmy. I'm a Magic fan too, though. Watching Paolo Banchero this year has been pretty fun. It's been good to watch him in his second season. He's doing pretty good. And that's a fun team to watch too. They're doing a lot better this year than they did last year. So that's fun to watch. But yeah, playoff Jimmy, he's worth the money. That's for sure.
Yeah, maybe you and I need to come back and do a basketball podcast next.
Yeah. There we go.
There you go. All right. Well, Ed, as always, I appreciate it. Again, you can find all of his work at tcpalm.com and in the pages of the Treasure Coast newspapers. And Ed, where can people find you if they want to look for you on social media?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram is the easiest ways to find me. It's at tcpalmekiller. And then you can find me by my name, Ed Killer, on Facebook.
All right, Ed, it's always a pleasure. Enjoy the spring weather. Make sure you wear your sunscreen, and I will talk to you again soon.
Well, thanks again for having me, Tim. I always have fun on the podcast.
And that will do it for another episode of the State of Florida Sports Podcast. I'm Tim Walters, and to quote former South Florida Water Management District Governing Board Chairman Federico Fernandez, Lake Okeechobee is often referred to as the liquid heart of the Everglades. The management of this 730-square-mile lake impacts each and every one of the 8.1 million residents we serve. That's a big impact, and it needs to be brought back into balance. Thanks for listening, and join me again next time.